Okay, now, first of all, what do we know about the narrative in Midsummer Night's Dream? What happens at the very beginning of the play? Who is on stage and what happens in the first scene? Alina. What? We're talking, what I'm going to do in the next 5 minutes is to get some sense from all of you as to what you know about the narrative in the play. So what happens right at the beginning? Alina.
The whole play is revolving around Hermia, who loves Lysander.
Yeah, what happens at the beginning? As the curtain opens.
Oh, there's a speech.
By whom? Who's on stage? Not sure. All right, well, Adam's going to sort you out.
Is it Bottom?
No, it's not Bottom. Not Bottom. Lily.
Theseus.
Now tell us about Theseus. Why is he on the stage? What's happening? Alina, listen to Lily. What?
Alina, remember. Wait.
Don't look at anything. No, don't. This is memory test. This is not research.
All I know is he's talking about his wedding to Hippolyta, which is...
He's talking about his wedding to Hippolyta. Who's Hippolyta?
His fiancé.
Right. Who bursts in on Theseus and Hippolyta? Jessica.
Is it Aegeus?
Aegeus. I don't know. It could be Aegeus.
Is it Aegeus?
I'm not sure. It's Aegeus. Aegeus, yeah.
Is that who comes in?
Yeah, what does he want?
He wants Theseus... to change the law?
No.
No?
He wants Theseus... What does he want to do about the law? Jay? He wants to enforce the law. For what reasons, Alina?
Because he doesn't want his daughter to marry Lysander, so he gives her the option of either coming and dying, or he's going to kill her, or she has
good.
To marry him.
Good. Excellent. So we have that. So what happens then to Hermia at that point, Joshua? What does she do? Does she say, yes, Daddy, all right, I'll marry Demetrius?
Does she rebel against him and say, does someone else have the eyes or something?
That's right. Yeah, she rebels against him. And what does rebellion lead to for her?
She runs away.
Yeah, she runs away. Where does she run to?
The forest.
With whom?
Lysander.
The one with the tattoos, the one with the twos down the back of his neck. That's right, motorbike and sidecar, tattoos down the back of his neck. Does Hermia talk to anybody before she runs away to the forest? Adam.
I also don't know.
Yes, you do. Does she have a best friend?
What's her name? Is it Helena.
She talks to Helena. What does she tell Helena? Come on, you did it this morning. You were playing Helena. You did a beautiful job as Helena.
Wow.
You should do it all your life long.
I
don't care what you were.
Oh, is that the scene where she's talking to Helena and... they're talking and she keeps...
Helena and Hermia.
Yeah.
Helena.
That's what the two ladies are.
Yeah, I'm talking about the two ladies.
Hermia is talking to Helena and telling Helena what? What does Hermia... Helena is Hermia's best friend. You got that right. Tick. So what does she tell her best friend before she runs into the forest with her lover?
Isn't she saying how much she loves him and stuff like
that? Who?
She loves Lysander, but
yeah,
she doesn't
that's
want
one
to
thing.
Be with...
That's one thing she tells.
Yeah, okay.
What else is she telling Helena? Lily, you can help him. What is Hermia telling Helena when just before she runs into the forest?
Does she encourage her to pursue the truth?
No, I don't think so. Jessica?
She's telling her that she's actually going to run into the
she's
forest.
She's telling Helena that she's actually going to run into the forest. So she tells Helena, that stupid girl. So, okay, she runs into the forest. Helena now knows that Hermia is going to run away with Lysander and run away from the person she's supposed to marry. Who's she supposed to marry?
Demetrius.
So what do you think Helena does at this point? When Hermia's gone, what does Helena do at that point? Not you, Jess, not yet. Jamie, what does Helena do at that point? You played Helena this morning. You should know.
I did.
You did.
Yes, I did.
Go. I don't think you did, but anyway, he's doing a good job.
Everyone played Helena.
She what?
I remember there was a part where she did. She just followed them?
Yeah, but there's something that happened first. She went and told somebody. Yes, Lily?
She told Demetrius.
She told Demetrius that Hermia was running off to the forest with Lysander. What do you think Demetrius did at that point, Josh?
He goes to... Does he go to the forest?
Goes to the physio.
Does he go to the forest?
He goes to the forest as well. He runs off to the forest. And what does Helena do when Demetrius runs off to the forest, Adam? Why?
Because she's obsessed with
Demetrius. Excellent. So we've got all that. It's all there. Fine. Now, that's one plot. There's two other plots happening in the play. What's the second plot that appears in the play? Yes. Go on, Josh.
Is that the normal people?
The rustics.
The rustics.
What are they doing?
They're performing their play or practicing.
Where are they practicing their play?
Forest.
In the forest. So the forest is where everything happens. Yeah. They're performing their play in the forest.
Yes.
That's great. Who are some of the characters?
Peter Quince.
Snout.
Snug.
Starveling. Good. So we've got all those. That's the second plot. There's a third plot. You can tell us, Jessica. Go.
The one with the fairies.
The fairies. Who are some of the fairies?
So we've got Park, and then you've got like Fairy 1, Fairy 2, Mustard Seed.
You missed out the most important ones.
Oh, like Oberon and Titania.
They're the king and the queen.
Yeah.
So what are they? Where are they? In terms of the location. No.
In the forest.
Everybody's in the forest.
You listen to me, I'm sorry.
And okay, what is the interaction that occurs between the fairies and the rustics, the players, and the lovers? What does anybody know what sort of happens there? How does Shakespeare construct that interaction?
It's
yes, John?
Like the Jujos, like how Titania falls in love with Bosco.
Yeah, but how does that happen? Don't jump too fast.
What's his name?
Oberon? Puck?
Puck, he puts the stuff on the eyes.
Why does he?
Because he wants Oberon.
He wants Oberon, or Oberon wants...
Oberon tells him to do it. Isn't it because they took the kid or something? I didn't get that part.
You didn't get that. Who got that part?
The changeling kid.
You got to tell Josh what happened there.
Fine. Titania got this cool changeling kid, and she's keeping him. The changeling kid.
Changeling. Yeah. Is that right? Changeling.
Yeah. And she's keeping him all to herself, but Oberon wants the changeling kid. So he's going to pull a wicked prank.
Why does he want him?
Because he's
cool.
He wants a slave.
He wants him to be a little worried boy.
So Puck then has gone around the world and found this special substance. And what happens with that special substance? Which eyes?
Titania's,
Lysander's. And then what impact does this have on the lovers and on the artisans, the rustics?
Lysander falls in love with the wrong person.
Who does he fall in love with?
He falls in love with Helena
instead of Hermia.
Yeah, instead of Hermia, and then Titania falls in love with Bottom.
That's right. What happens to Bottom when Titania falls in love with him?
Becomes an ass.
An ass? An ass. There is a distinction between an ass and an ass, in case you didn't know.
An ass.
That's right, ass.
Yeah,
unless you're an American, you say ass. That's different again. Okay, so that's good. We've got the basics of the plot there. There's more to come, of course, but we're going to jump in now to the scene that we finished off with in the lecture, Bottom's dream. And we're going to try and tie that in with Theseus' concluding speech about imagination. So we're at the end of Act 4, Scene 1. Act 4, Scene 1. It is page
885.
So, What happened to Bottom just before he was magicked into a ass? What happened to Bottom just before he was magicked into an ass? What?
They were doing the practicing the rehearsing the they play were, and then Pop came.
That's right. They were practicing the play. They were rehearsing the play. And then he turned into an ass. And what happened to Quince, Snuggling, Stout, Starveling? What happened? What happened?
Were they frightened?
They were terrified. Imagine if I ran into you in the forest and you turned into a donkey. I'd die a trillion. They were terrified. So, Bottom has suddenly surfaced from his bed with Titania. Why has he suddenly surfaced from that? Why has that suddenly ended, that relationship between Titania and...
Because Titania's like, oh, you're actually an ass and a human, I'm going to leave.
That's right, because Puck came in and turned the spell, turned it around, because Oberon felt that he'd gone too far. Oberon turned it around, that's right, Oberon did. He wanted to turn it around because he felt he'd gone too far. So this is where we start. And Bottom wakes. When my cue comes, call me and I will answer. What's a cue? What's that about?
Okay.
Here you go.
It's like a prompt when someone comes on stage.
So why does Bottom wake, and that's the first thing he says? When my cue comes, call me and I will answer. Where's Bottom in his mental space when he says that? Adam?
Rehearsing his play.
He's still rehearsing his play, so he hasn't really disconnected. He feels he's still there with the people that he was performing with and what's just happened to him. Some you go.
Is he in Fairyland or in the forest?
He's in the forest. Okay. But the forest is also Fairyland. That's right. When my cue comes, call me and I will answer. My next is Most Fair Pyramus. Hey ho! My next what?
Line.
Lily. My next what?
Line.
Line or my next cue. My next cue, in fact, cue is what's referred to in the previous sentence. My next cue is, well, what's Most Fair Pyramus? How can that be his next cue? That's the character he's going to be playing in the play. He's going to be playing opposite to Pyramus. He's going to be playing Thisbe, I think.
Oh, right, yeah.
Hey ho, footnote says, or side note says, that's possibly a yawn. Hey ho, yawn. Peter Quince, flute, the bellows mender, snout, the tinker, starveling. God's my life. Stolen hence and left me asleep. What's happening, Alina?
They've left him.
And what's his response?
And he's just woken up.
Where the hell are they? I thought I was here working. Where the bloody hell are they gone? Right. Now, I have had a most rare vision. I have had a dream past the wit of man to say what dream it was. Okay, what's that telling us? Jamie. What's he suddenly... He's moving away from worrying about where they've gone and he's suddenly remembering something. What's he remembering? I've had a most rare vision. I've had a dream past the wit of man to say what dream it was.
You're just saying that he had a dream which felt like more than a dream, like it felt too real to be a dream?
Yeah, he's had something and it's rare and it's a vision, which is something. A vision is a sort of a big word, really, a vision. A dream past the wit of man. What's past the wit of man? What does wit mean in the Shakespearean times?
Intelligence.
Sorry, Adam?
Intelligence.
Intelligence. Yeah, intelligence. Past the intelligence of man.
I think it can comprehend, like it didn't follow like any laws of mankind.
Yep.
So it was like way out there.
That's right. Way out there's a good way of putting it. So Bottom, who, you know, is normally inarticulate and full of all the wrong words, is suddenly kind of talking about something that's way out there. And then he says, man is but an ass if he go about to expound this dream. Now, maybe that's supposed to be a joke, partly. Why would it partly be a joke, Lily?
Yes, to use the wrong one. Right. And yourself if you try to
Why is it a bit of a joke?
Because he just was.
Because he probably still is.
Yeah.
He might still, it depends on how you direct this, he might still in fact have his big ears up here. And he doesn't realize it about himself. Like you don't realize about yourself now, Josh, that you've got two big ass's ears coming outside of your head. Mm-hmm. That's it.
You should check
him
out, just in case.
You did check, I noticed. So man is but an ass if he go about to expound his dream. Okay, there's the joke side of it, but what else is there? Man is but an ass if he go about to expound this dream. So what's in Bottom's mind when he says that?
I think he means that if he tries to tell this to anyone, they're not just going to laugh at him.
That's right.
Because it is way too ridiculous.
It's way too ridiculous. It's way beyond the bounds of anything that he's ever come across. Then we've got this. Methought I was... There's no man can tell what. Methought I was and methought I had, but man is but a patched fool if he will offer to say what methought I had. What's going on here in these kind of broken utterances, intentionally broken, incompleted sentences, and then this allusion to a patched fool, which is weird?
He's kind of saying that, like he's starting to say, oh, it's like I was, and then he realizes he doesn't actually have any words, that what he can remember is, like, he's literally left speechless and just saying,
yep,
kind of, there's no, like, nothing in mankind can actually say what it felt like I saw was.
Yep, yep.
And, yeah, and if I try and say what had happened in that dream, then I'd be a fool. Like, only an idiot jester would actually try and describe this wondrous, mind-blowing thing.
Right, good. Now, idiot jester, patched fool. Footnote. There is a footnote. Jester is a patchwork or motley costume. Now, I don't know if I'm reading things into this. I might well be. But if you've read a lot of Shakespeare, and if you've read a fair bit from the times of Shakespeare, the motley fool or the jester was often seen to be not a fool, but to be a wise man. And in King Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear, King Lear is actually accompanied throughout the play by a fool. The fool was often the court jester. And in Shakespeare's King Lear, the court jester, in fact, using what the world might say is stupid jokes and stupid songs, the court jester actually betrays an understanding of King Lear that he himself doesn't understand, and in fact gives King Lear some wisdom that he wouldn't have got in any other way. And in fact, there's books been written about the tradition of the fool in the medieval and the Renaissance period. The fool, by virtue of being outside social norms, because the fool is not interested in climbing up the ladder of competitiveness, the fool is sort of outside the framework of normal society. The fool has a certain, what's the word? Not anonymity, but... Sorry?
Satirical.
He is satirical, but he has a certain, he's not...
Animosity.
What?
Animosity.
Anonymity, maybe. That might be the word I was looking for. Anonymity's... He's sort of he's beyond the laws of the land. He's kind of got his own space. The jester has, the patched fool. So all that I'm saying, there might be something of that in Bottom's reference to the patched fool. But man is but a patched fool if he will offer to say what methought I had. So, is Shakespeare saying, is Shakespeare implying maybe that Bottom is something like a patched fool? That's what I think I'm trying to get at. Is Shakespeare implying that Bottom is a kind of a patched fool? And if he is implying that Bottom is a kind of a patched fool, if that is the implication, then Bottom may in fact be the carrier of some kind of wisdom, even though you can't name it and can't find the words for it. Because look at the next sentence. Look at the next sentence. Bless you.
Thank you.
The eye of man hath not heard, the ear of man hath not seen, man's hand is not able to taste, his tongue to conceive, nor his heart to report what my dream was. And then look at footnote 6. The eye through to report, burlesque of scripture. The eye hath not seen and the ear hath not heard, neither have entered into the heart of man those things that God has prepared. 1 Corinthians. Which is, from Corinthians, is the eye hath not seen, the ear hath not heard, neither have entered into the heart of man. Is that an expression of how little we really know of God's presence? Yeah, go, Josh.
It sounds like he's almost like a messiah, like in that height. Like he knows all this knowledge, like it's too much for him, and he doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, well, that's a good way of posing a question about it. Well, it's worth saying that. Is that what's the case? I mean, either Bottom is completely stupid off this planet and just opening his mouth and saying rubbish, or Shakespeare is using Bottom in a way that, I mean, remember that this is Bottom's dream. And remember, the play is actually called Midsummer Night's Dream. It's called Midsummer Night's Dream. So Midsummer Night's Dream refers to the whole things that are happening in the forest. But Bottom's dream is right bang in the middle of it. And, well, what is this dream? Is this a dream that takes us beyond normal conventions into some truths? I'm interested that the editor in this volume has said that this passage is a burlesque of scripture. Who knows what a burlesque is? You've all got iPhones, you've all got computers.
I mean, just think of the movie.
No, don't think of the movie.
It's a type of, sure, but it's usually a relatively titillating sure.
Look it up, burlesque.
It's a type of comedy. Are you in?
It's a good mood humor.
Yes.
Hmm?
Are
no.
you in humor?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that's when we did bells. Which means it's in here somewhere.
Humor? What do you mean, humor?
It's a.
Humanities.
Here we go.
Okay. An absurd or comically exaggerated imitation of something, especially in a literary or dramatic work, a parody.
An absurd imitation of something, a parody of something. Now that's what the editor says. The editor has said that this is a parody. Now why would Shakespeare parody Corinthians through the mouth of Bottom? You don't have to believe what editors say. The eye of man hath not heard, the ear of man hath not seen, man's hand is not able to taste, his tongue to conceive, nor his heart to report what my dream was.
Well, he's got all his senses mixed up.
Has he?
Yeah, like he goes.
Yeah, I heard.
The ear of man hath not seen.
That's right. So that's an important observation. So this has got all his senses mixed up and confused. So is that the main reason why Shakespeare has used this? To show us that Bottom's senses are totally confused? Is that the main force of this parody, burlesque of Corinthians? Jamie's not sure. Jamie's deeply pondering this at the moment. He's got some visionary insight which is about to pop out. Tell us. Big loud voice so Lily can hear you. She might not.
Thanks, Jamie. I'll manage.
I think it's sort of like Shakespeare's way of using sarcasm now, because Bottom is supposedly the fool, the one that no one would think, no one would like pay attention to.
Yeah. Yep.
But then eventually he became the main character of the supposed dream, where he was the one that got turned into a donkey, and he was the one that had all this adventure. So during that time period, it was almost like Lysander and Helena and Hermia and Demetrius, they all got they all became like supporting characters.
Yep.
And then Bottom became the main character, like the fool that everyone thought he was.
Yep.
Turned out to be the main character that everyone has their eyes on.
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
it. Yep.
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking.
What do you think to that, Alina? Are you agreeing with that or not?
Yeah, kind of, in that, like, you know how you're, like, I think he's using, like, with mixing up the senses, his words, like, he's using this person who we perceive to be, like, the fool.
Yeah.
But then he says some of the most, like, eloquent things in this play. So he's like,
that might be pushing it a bit far.
Yeah, like this, but this like,
yeah,
this little part. Like he's saying, we could talk for hours about what he's saying in this part because it's so like...
mysterious.
Yeah. So like he says some things which you wouldn't expect a fool to say. So I guess it's like Shakespeare's way of like juxtaposing the, like this, like he's a fool but he's saying all these things.
That's right. Good. And then following on then, Bottom says, I will get Peter Quince to write a ballad of this dream. It shall be called Bottom's Dream because it had no bottom. And I will sing it in the latter end of a play before the Duke. Peradventure, to take it the more gracious, I shall sing it at her death. Yes, Jess.
I wanted to just comment on the first part because I found it, I wrote my blog on this earlier today.
Yep.
But the first part of that, so I will get Peter Quince to write a ballad of this dream. Bottom has just spoken about how no one can comprehend his idea in this dream. And then he's like, oh, but Peter Quince can write a ballad about it.
Yep.
Like, I just thought that was really interesting.
Because, why, what's the interest there?
Well, it's just ironic because he said that...
It's beyond comprehension.
Yeah. He says it's like... No one can comprehend it.
Yep.
Anyone is an ass if they try to understand it. People will be a fool if they offer to say what they thought his dream was. And then he's like, oh, I'm just going to get Peter Quince to write about it now.
So
and then we'll perform it.
Is it like Bottom's ego surfaces at that point? He says, oh, I'll get Peter Quince to write a ballad of this dream. Is it the old... Bottom, who likes to take centre stage, is it that part of him that's surfacing at that point?
I think so. I think part of it could be, so the first kind of half, back to the talking about Corinthians,
yep.
He's kind of got that biblical sense of, you know, this is so big and so marvellous, and, you know, this is God-like what I've understood, and then that ego steps in, he's like,
yep.
Oh, this is so cool, you know, my dream can be the next Bible or whatever.
And then the next half, the next sentence, it shall be called Bottom's Dream because it hath no bottom.
Yeah, like it's so deep, like it has so many layers.
That's right.
Of understanding.
And I'm sort of wondering, where is Shakespeare in that? It shall be called Bottom's Dream because it hath no bottom. As Shakespeare's writing this in the play, is Shakespeare, wanting to kind of confirm our sense that Bottom's got a kind of an unfathomable wisdom that kind of connects us with something that in the ordinary sense we might not connected with. It's something that's, he says it's visionary. Is there something beyond the material that Bottom is kind of close to, but that Bottom wants to sing it at the latter end of a play before the Duke, so Bottom wants to kind of showcase it at the same time. So it's a bit of like a mixed motivations kind of going on in that speech. Wish Mr. Shakespeare could come in here and tell us exactly what he meant.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? Now, I want to connect this speech. What time is it? We've got time. I want to connect this speech. You see, there's no answer to it. There's no answer. Shakespeare didn't provide an answer. You get many different versions. And, you know, in a production of this play, you could get the director who presents Bottom on the stage... as a dreamlike character, who's a visionary character, who's, you know, seeing things, comic but seeing things. Or you get a bumbling idiot on the stage you would not trust. So the director could swing this one way or the other. But I suspect that when we link this with the speech at the beginning of Act 5, I suspect that there's more at stake here than we think. When I say more at stake, I mean that it's more than just sort of like a funny burlesque, a funny parody of nothing. You know, when we come to the Tempest, and when we think back to Midsummer Night's Dream, I like to think that Shakespeare has got a profound respect for imagination. What does that mean? It means that he feels that imagination can go further and take us deeper than reason and rationality can. What does that mean? So here we are, Act 5, Scene 1. So this is this speech, which I think you'll recognise is not so different from Bottom's speech, but it's in very different language. So Hippolyta and Theseus have just met these lovers who've come out of the forest, and they've been telling them all the things that have been happening to them in the forest and who loves who now. And Hippolyta says, "'Tis strange, my Theseus, that these lovers speak of." What these lovers speak of? Theseus. "More strange than true. I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies, that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends." Now let's just take those five lines. What's Theseus' opening statement in this speech? More strange than true. So obviously, what's Theseus' position on what he's heard of that's happened
these
in the forest?
Liars.
What?
These liars.
These liars, exactly. These liars. "I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends." So who is Theseus comparing lovers to? And what is he saying that lovers and madmen, what are their brains like? Lily.
I can always chill out.
You're chilling out then, were you?
Tuning out.
Or tuning out.
I always just thinking about other Shakespearean concepts. Yep. That's
very good. So
can you repeat the question just for the sake of...
All right, the question is... Theseus is trying to say that lovers and madmen are the same, and that they're both, he classifies them both in the same category in lines 4, 5, and 6. What's he saying in lines 4, 5, and 6 about lovers and madmen?
They all have overactive imaginations.
And what is he saying is the problem with overactive imagination? How does it compare to reason? So what does Theseus believe in is the instrument of truth in the human being?
Logic and reason.
Logic and reason. Theseus thinks that logic and reason are the only things that can apprehend the truth. He goes a step further. "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold," that's the madman. "The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt." So, Adam, those four lines, what's he saying about the link between the lunatic, the lover, and the poet? What links them? Overactive imaginations is their crime, or their what makes them dysfunctional. That's what he's saying. They're dysfunctional because they've all got too much imagination. And what examples does he give?
Uh,
More devils than you could possibly find in hell?
Yeah.
That's the madman. What about the lover?
What about Helen of Troy?
Or Cleopatra?
All that. I'm not really sure, to be honest. What he means by the brow of Egypt?
The brow of Egypt is a gypsy's face, or the colour of her face. Egyptian women are dark-skinned. How can you see beauty in dark skin? My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Remember that sonnet?
Yeah.
So Theseus is saying what about the lover? Has the lover got accurate perception of things? No. No accurate perception. So then we've got the next lines, 12 onwards. This is one of the most famous lines out of Shakespeare. And it's interesting that it comes in Theseus's mouth, who disbelieves what he's saying. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Now that is a description of imagination and the poet's pen. It would be really good if we could get very clear what Theseus is saying here. These lines have often been taken out of context and have been used to say what Shakespeare thinks about the imagination and the poet. And when you put them back in context, they're being spoken by someone who doesn't believe what they're saying. Give it a go, Josh.
Is he like with the heavens, earth, and earth to heaven? Are they like going too far?
Who is?
And the poet? Is
that
what he's trying to say?
Well, what part of the poet is he talking about?
Their imagination.
The poet's eye. The eye. What does the poet's eye do? Where the poet sees. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, what does that refer to?
It's going everywhere
crazy. Well, that's, you could assume that might be. The thesis is saying that the poet's eye is like it rolling everywhere. Doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name.
Oh, okay, so like he's saying like random things that no one, like it's unheard of. He gives them shapes and a name, and like a habitation pretty much. Like he just brings them to life. Is that what you're trying to say?
Okay, that's good. Anyone like to add what Josh has said? Anyone like to amplify that or fine-tune it a little bit? Jay?
Like the poet, it's practically saying that the poet takes it upon themselves to be a god of, they create new things from nothing, they pluck new things from the air.
Yep.
And it's, these are fake, not real things, because poet making them up, but nonetheless.
And gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. What's Midsummer Night's Dream? Is it what's being described here? Poet's eye glancing from heaven to earth, earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shape and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Is that what Midsummer Night's Dream is? It is, isn't it? In fact, it's what the whole of this is. All of it. Airy nothing given a local habitation and a name. This is Theseus's comment about the poet's eye, and yet I can feel Shakespeare behind this. And then Theseus continues, such tricks hath strong imagination, that if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. Okay, what are those three lines saying, Jamie? So Theseus is kind of criticizing the function of imagination here And how is he criticizing it in these three lines, 17 to 20? Apprehend means to apprehend is to see, to foreshadow, to apprehend, to see, yeah. Such tricks of strong imagination that if we but apprehend some joy.
Apprehend means to grasp and to catch.
Apprehend means to catch.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So apprehend some joy, as he catches some joy, he immediately comprehends some bringer of that joy. So Theseus is saying what is a.
I think he doesn't see like the point of having such a strong emotion.
That's right, he doesn't. And the next example is even clearer. Or in the night, imagining some fear, how easy is a bush supposed to bear? Don't you remember when you walked outside last night, Josh, and you saw a bush and you said, "Oh my God, a bear!" You weren't scared.
I love how that is.
So what's that saying about, what's Theseus saying about the imagination here?
It's overpowering, I guess.
Yeah. So overall, what's Theseus's...
It makes
you
unlogical.
Yeah. So overall, Theseus's view about imagination is what?
It's not logical.
That's right. And so if you put Theseus's comment next to Bottom's comment, put the way those two characters up there, they're both talking about vision. What's the difference? Yep.
One of them believes in visions and the other doesn't.
Yep, okay. Now let's listen to Hippolyta. She comes back. She's been listening to Theseus. Hippolyta started his conversation, "'Tis strange, my Theseus, that these lovers speak of." So she's got him off onto this track. And after he's had his track, she says, "But all the story of the night told over, and all their minds transfigured so together, more witnesseth than fancy's images, footnote 4, testifies to something more than mere figments of the imagination, fancy, and grows to something of great consistency, but howsoever, and in any case, strange and wondrous." Ah, so where is Hippolyta on this line of reason versus imagination? Jamie.
I think she believes that.
Why?
Like
does she believe?
She's convinced by their story, even though she has little, even though she herself admits that it is strange.
So what convinces her? Not Jamie, Alina.
That all this, they're all telling the same story.
Like all their minds
consistent.
Also, more than that, that word transfigured. All their minds transfigured so together. What's that kind of hinting at? Lily, you're with us this time, aren't you? Or not? It's too late on a Friday afternoon, is it?
Yes.
Yes.
So she's saying unless they've all dreamt the same dream together, they can't be making this up. Like it's just too coincidental.
All the story of the night told over, and all their minds transfigured so together, more witnesseth than fancy's images. Testifies to something more than mere figments of the imagination and grows to something of great constancy, but howsoever strange and admirable. What do you think, Jess?
I can talk now.
Yep.
So basically she's saying that there's more witnesses, like they've all witnessed this and that makes more...
Not more witnesses...
Sorry.
It witnesses to more.
Yeah. So it means more than just the figments of the imagination. So it's not just something that they're like they think is real, like it's actually real.
Yep.
And then it grows to something, because they think it's more than something that's a figment of the imagination. It grows to great constancy, which is more consistent. So their stories tie together better.
Yep.
But it's not a figment of the imagination.
Good. And there's important things here. First of all, notice that Hippolyta has the last word. Theseus doesn't come back to this. She has the last word. That's one thing. Maybe that's right. She has the last word. The other thing is the word fancy. Witnesseth more than fancies images. Now the footnote actually uses the word mere figments of the imagination. Now, if you go, if you haven't done 19th century literature with me, you won't know this so well, but if you've got your Norton anthologies, and you've got the anthologies for the 19th and 20th century, do you have those or not?
No.
Don't have them. Anyway, if you look up, if you Google Coleridge on fancy and imagination, write it down. Google Coleridge on fancy and imagination.
Coleridge.
Coleridge. Coleridge. You've heard of the poet Coleridge. You've heard of Samuel Taylor.
Names, yeah.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge was a great Shakespearean fan, and Coleridge wrote a few things, a few essays about Shakespeare's fancy and imagination. And fancy. Can anybody tell me what they think the difference is between fancy and imagination?
I mean, like, there's different connotations.
That's right, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, fancy is usually used as a, it's got negative connotations to it.
Yeah.
Imagination is like the neutral form of that concept to talk about. But fancy is saying, oh, that's just a fancy.
That's right.
Just something.
That's right.
And because it relates to fanciful, so
that's right.
That it's a silly thing or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you get the difference, Josh? Yeah. So if you want to follow that up, look at Coleridge on fancy and imagination, and he will refer to Shakespeare in that context. So... just to come back to Bottom's speech, if Hippolyta is challenging Theseus's critical and negative view of imagination, as she does here, and talking about the way that there's something that's happened that's transfigured these people, and something that's created great consistency, when I go back to read Bottom's speech, I'm less inclined to want to just pan it as stupidity, which you could do. It could be just a kind of a, you know, like Bottom talking out of turn, talking a lot of idiotic stuff just to get, you know, get laughs from the audience. I think it's more than that. But there's lots of people say all sorts of things about it, and there's no hard and fast rule about it. How are we doing for time? It's time! We got to the end of what I wanted to do. That's brilliant. Very, very unusual. Very unusual. Okay, so next week we're going to... I've got... read Study Act 5 because we're going to actually do the play within a play. And if we get any time for anything else, we'll do something else as well. But I want to do Pyramus and Thisbe and Bottom and Snug and Moons and Lions and all that stuff. It's great. It's fantastic. I was going to show you the film today. I had a real dilemma this morning. Am I going to show them a film or are we going to do a workshop? I'm glad we did the workshop, because you can all watch the film yourself if you want to. It's the Klein film. It's very readily available. It's worth looking at. It lasts about 180 minutes. Sorry?
It's a long movie.
No, it's not 180 minutes. Sorry, it's 120 minutes. I could have shown it within the 2 hours this morning, but I thought that would have been... Yeah. That's all you would have done. That's right. So have a good weekend, folks.
You too.
This is week 8, next week's week 9, and then we're into double figures, and then we're nearly home and hose. And remember, next Friday, those of you that want to come to New York, and I can tell you that it's really good fun, I'm looking forward to it. We've got a session next Friday morning at 10 o'clock, information session about New York. Good. And you, Jessica, is it you who's going away to Rome?
Yeah, Helena and I.
That's right, Helena. See you, Adam. I'm going to have to send you an email because the head of school says that's fine, but you've got to send the details in. So I have to send you an email and you have to give me the details.
Okay.
That's it.
You can have whatever details you want.
Okay. What are you plugging into now, Adam? It's not the Rolling Stones, is it?
No, it's not.
But what if it was?
What if it was?
Wild.
Wouldn't it be?
No, to be honest.
You don't?
Shuffle. I haven't
chosen. Is it a shuffle, is it?
It's one of the Spotify playlists.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
I never realised they did, like, weekly playlists for you, like, just
right.
Randomly for you.
Yeah, they design it based on what you listen to, which is
so I've started just listening to them now, sort of.
So is it good?
Must be. It usually gives, like, a pretty, because usually they give you, like, three, and it gives you, because I listen to a lot of different generally find that one will be more like rock and metal kind of stuff, then one will be more